Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Skid Road, An Informal Portrait of Seattle, by Murray Morgan. Introduction by Marianne Gwynn. Narrated by Bob Sauer. Introduction. When I washed up on the shores of Seattle in 1983, I could not make sense of the place. Never mind the cattywampus street grid, where the north-south streets suddenly changed their minds and ran northwest. What kind of town was this? It was prosperous enough, all those Boeing paychecks, but its citizens had a curious disregard for appearances. Some wind-burned, fleece-wrapped codger rolling down the streets of Ballard might have made millions fishing in Alaska. The people were a variety of ethnicities, completely different from the stark racial divides of the South, where I grew up and came of age. It was a tantalizing mix, but I couldn't figure out the recipe. So I did what I have always done. I went looking for a book to explain it all. An editor in the Seattle Times newsroom, where I had landed a reporting job on the night shift, told me to check out the Elliott Bay Book Company, and I drove down to Pioneer Square on a dismal Saturday in February. I followed the signs into the bookstore's basement cafe, where patrons parked themselves at rickety wooden tables with a cup of coffee and a book or two, then up the stairs to the main floor. I asked a clerk, a balding fellow with thick, black-rimmed glasses, a salt-and-pepper beard, and a sweater that had seen better days, for advice. What book should I read to understand Seattle? Skid Road, he said, without a beat of hesitation, pointing to the right of the cash register toward the Northwest History section. There it was, a green-gray paperback with a cover photo of some old clapboard buildings, a raggedy, clear-cut hill behind them. I paid for it out of my third paycheck, took it home, and read it in two sittings. I learned, as so many other people have from this book, why I had come to Seattle. Skid Road, named for the muddy downhill track that split Seattle between its respectable precincts and its dark underbelly, where ox teams skidded logs to Yesler's Mill, is a history of Seattle told from the point of view of the misfits, geniuses, ideologues, and grifters who built our city on a foundation of dreams, greed, and, every so often, regard for their fellow man. They had fled the East, where they didn't fit, and found a place where they did. They shaped their own hole to fit their personal peg, following the lead of the oddest character of all, city founder Doc Maynard, a mashup of a man with terrible business instincts and a heart of gold, a do-it-yourself do-gooder who adopted young children orphaned by an Indian raid, an anti-abolitionist who lived, worked with, and admired the Indians and learned their language, doctored their illnesses, drank their liquor, paddled their canoes. In his preface to Skid Road, author Murray Morgan stated his mission. This book is the story of Maynard and of the men like him, the ones who weren't quite respectable but helped build the great city of the Northwest. The formal history of Seattle has been written many times over, sometimes well. The sons and daughters of the men who moved north of the Skid Road have lovingly told the story of the folk who dreamed the right dreams at the appropriate times. This is the story of the others, of some who tried and failed, and of some who achieved success without becoming respectable, of the life that centered on the mills and on the wharves, that is, Seattle from the bottom up. I was one of those eastern dreamers who wandered west, and I found in Skid Road a portal into the history and character of a city I've now called home for 35 years. Today, I believe that Skid Road still says something elemental about Seattle. I am in distinguished company. Timothy Egan, the National Book Award-winning author whose own The Good Rain is another essential book about the Northwest, has this to say about Skid Road. Over more than half a century, no one has written a better book about Seattle. I keep looking for something, but Skid Road has our soul down cold. That book absolutely inspired me when I set out to write The Good Rain, trying to get at what makes us tick in this corner of the country, and trying to bring history alive with a laugh. Before Skid Road, most history books of this region and our city were dry and drab or booster pablum. Those books were about statues and railroads and number of airplanes built. Morgan dug deeper and found something so much richer and something the chamber types would never have authorized. We're a quirky place. Our graft, our corruptions, our pretensions are unique to a city that tried to level its hills. The reason that book has achieved immortality is because it's an honest look in the mirror. Email to Marianne Gwynn, July 20th, 2017. Marie Morgan wrote a brilliant book, and readers embraced it. Skid Road has been reprinted at least 6 times and remains, by most accounts, the best-selling history of Seattle. Who was he, and how and why did he produce a Northwest classic? Marie Morgan was a journalist who traveled the world, who wrote for national newspapers, magazines, and radio, who could have been a star in the national firmament. But he wanted to stay home, and home was the Northwest. He was born in Tacoma in 1916 to a preacher father and a fortune-telling mother. Henry Victor Morgan was a Universalist minister, a socialist, and a mystic. Ada Camille Lane Parn Morgan was a Nebraskan by birth, a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution, a clairvoyant who read tea leaves and wrote sentimental poetry. Marie inherited his mother's deep attachment to the natural rhythms of the Northwest. Mother was part Indian, he remembered, in At the Field's End, a 1987 collection of interviews with Northwest writers. I always felt that her response to the land around here was the Indian response. Ada was a widow with twin sons, and Henry Victor had a son and daughter by a former marriage. Marie was the only child of their union. The house where he was born, a gingerbread Victorian that still stands on the ridge of a hill overlooking Commencement Bay, offered a northwest panorama that swept from the southern reaches of Puget Sound to Mount Rainier. In an essay called One Man's Tacoma in Puget's Sound, his history of his hometown, he remembered that he could see the bay, the Cascades, the mountain. The enclosed world of the ravine with its singing stream, now buried as part of a storm sewer project, the expanse of salt water leading off to every seaport in the world, the ethereal bulk of the mountain sometimes manifest on the horizon. On quiet nights, one could hear the trains clanking along the waterfront, hear, too, the long whistles, mournful and romantic. The sea, the mountains, the forests, the trains that moved timber east and white settlers west, they were the borders of Murray Morgan's world. Everybody in the house was a storyteller. His mother, a sentimental versifier, also wrote children's plays. His father composed sermons and homilies for a national magazine he self-published. Though Murray inherited his parents' way with words, their religion didn't stick. In a November 1979 interview with the Seattle Weekly, Murray remembered an argument with his dad about religion. Murray told Henry Victor that he was, at best, a deist. Henry Victor was saddened, somewhat hurt, and shook his head and said, "Just a clod, untroubled by a spark. It is still a burr in my psyche." Marie's animating fire would burn with a different fuel. By the time he graduated from Tacoma's Stadium High School in 1933, Marie had made the Tacoma papers several times. One senses that he learned the art of self-promotion, a valuable tool in a writer's toolbox, at Henry Victor's knee. An early reference to Master Morgan came in a newspaper photo with the caption, "Church pastor buys third Ford, a sedan," with proud owners Henry Victor and Ada posing by their brand new Model T, little Murray perched on the running board. As a teenager, Murray piled up writing awards, duly noted in the newspaper, the Fire Prevention Week Essay Prize, Tacoma Daily News, November 11, 1932, and first prize in a Scholastic magazine writing contest for the essay How to Second a Boxer. With his sweater and tie, thick shock of brown-black hair, his mother's dark coloring, and a smile that seemed to radiate both warmth and mischief, Murray was a charmer. He attended the University of Washington, where he was editor of the UW Daily, the training ground for many talented Northwest journalists. Murray loved stirring up trouble, and he did, with a story about the number of students who had contracted venereal disease that year. Though there were only three cases, the administration suspended him for a day. He graduated anyway, cum laude, with a bachelor's degree in journalism in 1937. He worked at newspapers in Hoquiam and Tacoma and endured a short, unhappy stint as secretary of Seattle's Municipal League. He embarked on the love match of a lifetime by marrying Rosa Northcutt in his father's church in March 1939. The newlyweds took off for a European honeymoon and got a glimpse of history in the making. The world was about to convulse with change, and Murray would change with it. He had already traveled to Europe. Henry Victor, a man of means, even in the Depression, took Murray to both the 1932 Olympics in Los Angeles and the 1936 Games in Berlin, the Nazi stage-managed event. Murray and Rosa had bought a kayak at Lillehoyt's in London and put in at the Danube's headwaters at Ulm, traveling south by southwest through Europe, more or less disconnected from the news. Floating down 1,200 miles of the Danube in a kayak seemed like a lark, even if neither of them had ever paddled a kayak before, and Murray couldn't swim. "We just decided to go until we ran out of money," Murray remembered in the Seattle Weekly interview. "I've never liked bicycling very much, and I'd read a book called The Danube Flows Through Fascism." The author had paddled on the Danube through Germany and Austria, and it sounded fun. Murray loved to tell the story of what happened at the end of the trip with a humorous twist, but it was a harbinger of the violence to come. They had made it all the way to Romania, where they took a side trip, and, on their return, they ran into the Romanian state police, who demanded their identity papers and their intentions. Murray, trying to make himself understood, recalled that he tried every language in which I knew five or more words, but none of them worked, until I took a whirl at German. It was September 1939, and Murray and Rosa had missed the news that Hitler had just invaded Poland. Murray's attempts at German got them thrown into jail. He tried to make the case that they were American tourists, not German spies, and in a letter to a childhood friend described what happened as he tried to negotiate with a suspicious guard. "Okay," I said, decided that I had better take it easy. "I'll go back, but you telephone Bucharest." I repeated Bucharest about five times and made the motions of telephoning. Then I turned around and started back to the cell. Evidently feeling that he had me on the run, the dirty-faced dope made a lunge for my arm. I let him have it with my elbow in his stomach, and he grunted. By the time he straightened up, I was in the doorway and facing him. He took a couple of steps toward me, so I cocked my right and started jiggling my left around. I was all set to let him have a right when I saw a soldier coming down the passage. Romanian bayonets are 18 inches long, so I decided to sit down. My pal slammed the door. Letter to Frank Sadler, September 11, 1939. After an anxious night, Murray was able to convince another round of officials that he and Rosa were clueless American honeymooners and just wanted to go home. They did. The couple returned to Washington State, but Murray had seen the wider world and wanted to test its waters. He worked at papers in Spokane and Tacoma to save for tuition for Columbia University, where he had been accepted in the graduate program in journalism. Murray and Rosa moved to New York and were there on December 7, 1941, when Pearl Harbor was bombed. Suddenly, all the news outlets where Murray had vainly applied for employment called him at once. He worked at Time, CBS Radio, where he rubbed shoulders with William Shirer and Edward R. Murrow, and the New York Herald Tribune, juggling different shifts while Rosa went to class for him and took notes. After a post-grad trip to Mexico, Murray was drafted. He was sent to the Aleutian Islands with the Army Signal Corps, another experience that would expand a young man's tutorial in human nature. The Aleutians were cold, remote, and mostly out of the combat zone. Murray read a lot. Rosa sent him books, and began writing two of his own. Rosa did the research and sent him the materials. He got to know his fellow soldiers. Their daughter, Lane Morgan, has compiled Murray and Rosa's correspondence in a blog, Morgan Correspondence, and in his Aleutian letters, Murray documents his conversations with his fellow soldiers, including a future congressman and a future famous writer, Gore Vidal, who would eventually edit one of Murray's books. For the first time, he got to know black Americans and the people who despised them. In an April 1944 letter to Rosa, he wrote, There are a number of Negroes aboard, most of them Navy personnel. One night when I was working late, I took time out to talk to one of the Negroes who was on guard duty. He was a young fellow in his early 20s. Before volunteering for the Navy, he was a pre-med student with a year at Northwestern and a year at a Southern college. I asked what he thought about the war, and he said it was worth fighting to give the U.S. a chance to become a democracy. He was certain the Negroes would have an even tougher time than they do now if the U.S. should be defeated. He said that he liked a lot of things about the Russian system, but that he could not stomach violence and force used even for ends he agreed with. I asked what he thought of Russia's death penalty for anyone who preached racial intolerance. He said he did not believe in the death penalty. One of the white soldiers, who saw me talking to the pre-med boy, came up to me later and said, "Say, Shorty, you seem to like them shine." I said something about their being the same as anyone else, and he went into a big Jones laugh which showed all the gold in his front teeth and said, "They're ignorant, Shorty, they're just naturally ignorant. Never was a nigger could tell a white man nothing." And very pleased with himself, he scratched his testicles, rolled his shoulders, and sauntered out the door. In July 1944, Murray wrote Rosa, "Race prejudice seems to me the basic evil of our world and attitude toward race and color the crucial test of the Democrat. And while I am profoundly pessimistic about the future of democracy, I do not care to associate with those who do not wish to practice it." Murray was learning to look beneath the gloss of civilized behavior with the perspective of a journalist, a well-founded mistrust of authority, a respect for how history can overtake the mundane day-to-day, a belief that human beings are all the same underneath, capable of awful and good things, sometimes all at once. After the war, Murray and Rosa settled near Tacoma in King County. They found a funky former dance hall on Trout Lake near Auburn, moved in, and called it home for the rest of their lives. Murray got a job teaching journalism at the College of Puget Sound, now the University of Puget Sound, worked shifts on the copy desk at a Tacoma newspaper, and juggled freelance assignments. The couple's only child, Lane, was born in 1949. She vividly remembers her parents' literary partnership. Rosa was an able researcher, photographer, and the first editor for everything, Lane told me. They would go to the mat over wording. Was this being too snarky, or was this fair? Murray did the paying work, and Rosa did everything else, Lane remembered, welcoming and cooking for a stream of visitors to Trout Lake. She made a funky house seemed charming, Lane recalled. After Lane was grown, Rosa became a librarian. Murray loved teaching and would eventually come back to it, but after 5 years he was ready for something else. The student body was changing, from veterans on the GI Bill who had seen the world to a tamer group. Everybody wanted to work for Weyerhaeuser, he told the Seattle Weekly. He got in a tangle with the college administration over freedom of the press. Officials wanted to censor a story in the student newspaper about the rising cost of coffee in the school cafeteria. He'd published 5 books, including 2 mysteries, by the time he got his luckiest break. Malcolm Cowley, the legendary editor at Viking Press, came to Seattle to deliver the annual Walker Ames Lecture at the University of Washington. He asked for a tour guide, and he got Murray. As they drove around Seattle, Murray's stories of the city's rough-and-tumble years enthralled Cowley and prompted him to suggest, "Why don't you write a book about it?" Murray thought that was a great idea, since most of the books up to that point dealing with Seattle's vintage years had been written from the establishment point of view. Chet Screen, Seattle Times Sunday Magazine, August 20, 1978. Never one to pass on the main chance, he set to work, writing part of the book while working as a bridge tender for Tacoma's 11th Street Bridge. Cowley was his editor at Viking, and Murray said he learned everything he didn't know about writing from him. They hit on a structure perfect for Murray, an affectionate student of people, good, bad, and in between, a 2,000 to 3,000-word essay on an individual personality, then a short vignette about the historical period embodied by that person. Murray was telling the story of Seattle through the people who lived it. Though he would write and publish many more books and articles and go on to have a memorable career as a Tacoma radio personality, Skid Road, first published in November 1951 to mark Seattle's centennial, became Murray's signature book and his biggest hit, the one readers loved the most. Most readers, anyway. Murray relegated Seattle's revered founding families, the Dennys, the Borens, the Yeslers, to the margins of his story. The people he portrayed were far more entertaining. Doc Maynard, a warm human being whose worst faults grew out of his greatest virtue, his desire to be helpful. And few people ever got into more trouble trying to help others. Suffragist and labor firebrand Mary Kenworthy. She just couldn't help being for anybody who was against something, said one observer. Seattle's unapologetically corrupt mayor, Hiram Gill. Vaudeville impresario Alexander Pantages. Teamsters leader Dave Beck, who, when Skid Road was first published, held Seattle's unions, and by extension the city, firmly in his grip. Some first family descendants were not pleased. In Murray's June 24, 2000, Seattle Times obituary, author Bruce Brown recalled, "What Murray wrote was viewed as deeply subversive by Seattle's old guard. They were invested in the myth of Seattle as a nice little town, and they resisted the story that Murray wanted to tell, Seattle as a wild and raucous and multifaceted frontier town." Professional historians were unhappy that Murray didn't use footnotes, added in later editions. They may also have been just a little bit jealous that this rambunctious history of Seattle, written by a journalist, did so very well. Which leads to the question, while most history books gather dust, why has Skid Road turned into a classic, and why is it so timeless? Though he first published Skid Road in 1951, Murray Morgan had a profound grasp of our region's essence that makes it as fresh a read today as when I first encountered it 35 years ago. In Northwest Passages, a 1994 collection of writing about the Pacific Northwest, Bainbridge Island author Bruce Barcott named some of the strains of the Northwest's character. One is the restless nature of people who wind up here. If the Northwest is searching for its great literary theme, Barcott wrote, it may find it in the region's role as a catch basin for washed-up westering dreams. Since the time of Homer, to go west has been to travel into the romantic unknown. The Pacific Northwest is the final chance to find the golden land. This is where the westward dream runs out of room. For most of its history, Barcott writes, Seattle has attracted people propelled by dreams, whether it's toward a golden future or away from a nightmare past. Oddballs and loners are welcome, he wrote. We came out here to get away from failed farms, deranged spouses, nightmarish families, and sometimes the long arm of the law. Murray knew this. Though he was predisposed by upbringing and temperament to like oddballs, he chose to write about them because he knew that Seattle's attraction for the misfit has shaped the city for good and sometimes for ill. We are loath to judge, sometimes to a fault. We welcome new ideas, even if they are goofy. Our tolerance for the offbeat and the adventurous has shaped our politics, our booming, when it's not busting, economy, our distaste for organized anything, notably religion. Seattle has always been occupied by opposing and at times warring groups, including those agitating for political change and those making fortunes from the system. But both these groups require people who think outside the box, adventurers like Maynard, labor baron Beck, business geniuses and technological futurists like Bill Gates and Paul Allen, Howard Schultz and Jeff Bezos. The right thing for these individualists is not what everybody else is doing. They are looking for the main chance. They go for it. Murray was fascinated by people who were different, but his was not a sideshow sort of voyeurism. It was an authentic regard. He had learned something about stereotypes and what they can lead to. In Skid Road, he writes about Native Americans, women, and marginalized groups, notably the Chinese immigrants who, in 1886, were run out of Seattle by an angry mob, with respect and insight. And there's nothing sentimental about his agenda. Nevertheless, Skid Road displays some of the blind spots characteristic of its era. This is the history of the settlers and their city, written by a white man in the 1950s. Murray was acutely aware of the nature of Seattle's boom-bust economy, from the Klondike gold fever that exploded the city's population to the depressions and busts that thinned it out. A revised edition of Skid Road was published in 1982, just as Microsoft was embarking on its domination of the computer software industry, transforming the city into a destination for successful tech businesses. Though he didn't live to see it, he would have regarded without surprise the Amazon bubble. He knew that people both benefit and suffer from the ups and the downs of economic expansion. His chapters on the 1930s and the rise of Hooverville, the vast camp of the out-of-work and the homeless that sprang up on the Duwamish Flats, paint familiar pictures for anyone grappling with homelessness in Seattle today. Rootless people clinging to the margins of the city, cobbling together some sort of makeshift shelter, waiting for the city to come tear it down. He understood that Seattle's history would always ebb and flow. "The only certainty is that Seattle will continue to change," he wrote at the end of Skid Road. "Dead peaks come to life. New dreams continue to form." Murray had great fun with Seattle's embrace of a live, let live, and look the other way until it gets out of hand philosophy. He vividly portrays early Seattle's wide-open tolerance of prostitution, gambling, and binge drinking. In the early 1900s, 500 women worked in the brothels of Skid Road. A writer for McClure's magazine, making a visit during this era, wrote, "The cities seem to have been transformed almost magically into one great gambling hell. Only when eager entrepreneurs developed plans for a 250-room mega brothel on Beacon Hill was the city finally provoked to shut down the box houses, emporiums of entertainment, illegal gambling, and prostitution. The city looked the other way as Teamster President Dave Beck tightened his hold on the city with threats and corruption. It took a federal conviction on tax evasion charges to bring Beck down. Though they emerged after Skid Road was first published, Seattle's police corruption scandals of the 1960s were spawned by the city's tolerance of illegal gambling. There's one more reason Skid Road is so readable and relevant today. Marie Morgan was a gifted journalist and historian, but he was a born storyteller with perfect comic timing. Many have heard of the weeping women on the brig Exact, who endured a sea voyage of thousands of miles only to land in Seattle at the worst possible time, in November, in the rain. Marie's description is precise, wry, and knowing. Three of the four women cried when the brig's boat put them ashore on the salt-smelling beach. The sky was low and gray, the air sharp with salt and iodine, the wind cold. But soon the women were too busy to weep. His natural sympathy for the underdog makes for great storytelling, for in truth, most of us are rooting for them. Marie Morgan inspired a new generation of Northwest writers in the vein of Tim Egan, comic and irreverent, with a keen eye for the hidden costs of Western expansion. Another is Montana writer Peter Stark, who had the pleasure of spending hours with Murray talking about the ups and downs of the writing life. Stark is the author of the critically acclaimed Astoria, a lively history of how John Jacob Astor's lust for the riches to be made from the fur trade shaped the Northwest. Stark got to know Murray relatively late in the older man's life, after Murray had published 18 books, had a successful career as a muckraking radio journalist, and taught a legendary course in Northwest history that cast a spell on waves of Tacoma Community College students. The bridge over Tacoma's Theophos Waterway, where Murray worked as a tender, as he wrote Skid Road, had been renamed the Murray Morgan Bridge. Morgan liked to call himself an ad-lib historian, but by the time Stark met him, he was known as the Dean of Northwest History. In terms of grateful readers and published books, no one else came close. Stark's in-laws had a cabin on Harstein Island in South Puget Sound next to one owned by Murray and Rosa, on a beach the Morgans had been visiting since the late 1940s. Murray was in his 70s and had survived cancer by having a portion of his stomach removed. His shock of brown-black hair had turned gray, but he was still working on his next great project, a history of the Northwest's exploration through the sea otter trade. At Harstein, there were long days at the beach, leisurely meals, and long talks over drinks. Murray held court, telling tales. "He was a wonderful verbal storyteller," Stark told me. "Any subject you touched upon, he would instantly come up with a story, told with perfect storytelling symmetry, beginning, middle, and end. Instead of swimming, Murray would walk down the beach with a bucket collecting mussels and bring them back to Rosa, who would make them into a savory stew. Rosa was a wonderful person, warm and hospitable beyond description," Stark remembered. Stark had the usual struggles of a writer, finding the great idea, trying to get a publisher to notice, enduring the inevitable dry spell.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?